Chapter 37. Safi. Mum has tried to persuade me to stay behind, but I can't. I have to be there when the police speak to Gran. I need to protect her as best I can. I'm driving, and Mum is in the passenger seat, tension emanating from her. I knew the police would want to talk to Gran again, but the fact it's such short notice concerns me. Now they know Neil Lewisham died when she lived in the house. Is she a suspect? I just can't believe Gran knew about this, can you? I say, as we head towards the motorway. Mum remains silent, and I bristle. Can you? I don't know. I don't think so, honey, but... But what? I snap. You can't possibly think Gran is capable of murder. Mum snorts. Of course not. But that doesn't mean she doesn't know something. She could have been there when it happened, maybe even helped cover it up. I refuse to believe it. Gran is the most staid, law-abiding person I know. There's no way. Mum clenches her jaw, and I feel irritation bubble within me. I can't believe you can even doubt her. She's your mother. She's not perfect. She's human, just like the rest of us. I grip the steering wheel tightly, not trusting myself to speak in case all the resentments I've felt towards Mum for so many years threaten to spill out of me. And, continues Mum, she does mention a gene hitting someone over the head. Did she witness something? Of course she didn't. She's just coming up with random names. She was right about Sheeda, though, wasn't she? She's real. I've already told you what Alan said, and how I think Daphne's really Sheila Watts. We don't know that for definite. Next you're going to tell me you think Daphne is the other body in the garden. Do you think Gran killed her, too? Mum doesn't say anything. You think it's Daphne? I'm not saying that. But I spoke to Melissa earlier, and she said your Gran and Daphne moved out at the same time. I don't want to think badly of my mother any more than you do, but we have to face facts. That's ridiculous. Just because you have no faith in Gran, just because you've never bothered... I stop. I've said too much. Mum's silent for a few seconds. Then, what do you mean? Nothing. Forget it. No. If you've got something to say to me, I suggest you say it. I turn to Mum. Her mouth is pressed into an angry line. We haven't argued for years, not since I was a teenager, and she'd shout at me for my messy bedroom. Okay, then. I think you've been a bit... neglectful. Neglectful? Yes, you buggered off to Spain, left a lonely old lady by herself, hardly visited. How many times have you actually seen Gran in the last 6 years? Once or twice a year? That's not fair. It's true. And me? How many times have you seen me? And when you do come and visit, you bring along one of your many hideous boyfriends. And don't pretend you're happy about this baby. I'm on a roll now, and I can't stop, even though I know I'm being a bitch. I could see by your face how disappointed you were when I told you. Just because you regretted having me so young, it doesn't mean that I'm the same. Just because you couldn't wait to get rid of me every summer so you could go out and act like a teenager, leaving Dad and going off with other men. And do you wonder why I'm closer to Gran? There's a shocked silence. I can't quite believe I've said it. I dare not look at Mum. I'm not a confrontational person. It must be my pregnancy hormones. Even so, I know that's how I really feel and have felt for years. It's actually a relief to get it out. We continue driving in a tense, uncomfortable silence. My legs are trembling. From the corner of my eye, I see Mum wipe a tear from her cheek. And I'm consumed by guilt. I'm sorry, I say. I didn't mean all that. Yes, you did, says Mum quietly. It's my hormones. I just feel so angry. I know. She flashes me a watery-eyed smile. And I agree I haven't always been the best mother. I've made mistakes. Mum, don't. It's true. And you will too, whatever you think now. But I never regretted having you. Not for one second. I'd hate you to think that. I swallow the lump that's formed in my throat. By now we've reached Elmbrook, and I pull into the car park. As I push the gear stick into neutral, Mum covers my hand with hers. Are we okay? Of course, I say. If I feel trepidation at the thought of having a baby at 24, I can only imagine how scary it must have been for my 16-year-old mother. I should never have said those awful things. Joy greets us at the door with her usual harassed air. She looks more stressed than normal, but I can appreciate why. She's probably never had to contend with police coming over to interview one of her residents before. Mum is somber as we gather in the lobby. The ugly, swirly carpet is making me feel sick. Are the police here? Mum asks Joy. In there, Joy indicates the room we were in last time. I'll go and get Rose. She's still in her bedroom at the moment. She didn't have a very good night. I'll bring some tea. Anxiety pools in my stomach. In what way didn't she have a good night? I ask. She kept waking up, crying out. It happens sometimes. They forget where they are. Anyway, if you don't mind going in there. She pushes the door open and stands against it so we can go past her. I'll get Rose now. D.S. Barnes is already in the room, with someone else this time. A woman around my age. They are seated in the same armchairs at either side of the fireplace and stand up when we enter. He introduces the woman as D.C. Lucinda Webb. She has a coppery mane that spills over the shoulders of her patterned blouse. I notice Joy has put out only two extra chairs this time. You sit here, says Mum, indicating one of the chairs. I'm okay to stand. Are you sure? Of course. Sit. We're being unnatural with each other. Ultra polite. But I do as she says. There's an awkward silence, and I'm thankful when the door opens and Joy escorts Gran into the room. The sight of her brings tears to my eyes. She looks so frightened, like a shy little girl. I want to wrap her in my arms and take her away from all this. She seems thinner in her pink knitted jumper and pleated skirt, and I'm worried she's not eating enough. I notice she has on a gold necklace and matching earrings that I recognize, and I wonder if one of the carers put them on for her this morning to make her look nice. She sits next to me, blinking rapidly like a baby bird. I reach over and take her hand. Gran. Who are you? She says. And I feel like I've been stabbed in the heart. It's me, Safi, I say, trying not to cry. Before she can respond, Mum has crouched down by her side. Mum, she says, there's no need to be afraid. The police just want to ask you a few more questions. Why? Gran asks, then turns to me, bewildered. But there is recognition in her eyes. I squeeze her hand. It's okay, Gran, I say reassuringly. Mum stands up and hovers behind me, making the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I wish there was a chair for her. Why didn't Joy bring one? D.S. Barnes has his sleeves rolled up. It's not as hot as last time, but even so, there is a sheen to his forehead.
Hi, Rose, he says. It's nothing to worry about. Like your daughter said, we just want to ask a few questions. Is that okay?
I suppose, she says, folding her hands across her stomach. Joy returns with an extra chair, and Mum sits in it. D.S. Barnes looks vaguely irritated by all the disruption. When Joy has left the room, he continues.
Rose, does the name Neil Lewisham mean anything to you?
Gran turns to me, and I smile encouragingly. I don't think so, says Gran. D.S. Barnes pushes a photograph across the wooden table towards us. Gran stares down at it, her hand still in mine, fine-boned and delicate. I lean forward to get a better view. A man with short fair hair stares out at us. He's plain, ordinary. There is nothing about him that would make him stand out. He has on a long black overcoat. One hand is thrust into a pocket, and the other is holding a cigarette by his side.
This is the man who was found dead in your old house, Rose, he says gravely. We think he died in 1980, while you were living there.
Gran's eyes are wide with fright. It's okay, Gran, I say softly. What do you remember about this man? He was after us, she says, turning back to D.S. Barnes. I stare at her in shock. I assumed she wouldn't know him. I can't look at Mum. I haven't told the police about Sheila's file and the article in it with Neil Lewisham's byline, in case I end up implicating Gran somehow. What do you mean, Rose? Probes D.C. Webb, her voice gentle. And I realize that's why she's been brought along today. A woman's touch. My mouth is dry, and I'm still exhausted after last night's events. I notice Joy hasn't brought in the tea she promised. Did you hurt him, Rose? Or did Daphne? Lucinda Webb's voice is soothing, like honey in warm water on a sore throat. Gran takes her hand away from mine and reaches into her mass of white hair. I don't remember. Was he having a relationship with you? Or with Daphne? No, I don't think so. Did he come to the house, Rose? Do you remember? He was angry, says Gran. She seems calmer now, her hands resting in her lap. He was angry. Why was he angry? I stiffen. Can Gran really remember? Or is she confused again? He tried to hurt us. Why would he do that? Asks D.C. Webb. Because he found out about Sheila. I notice Mum has gone quiet. I don't know whether to say something. What if it lands Gran in trouble? Who's Sheila? Asked D.C. Webb in that same soothing voice. Gran stares into her lap silently. Mum glances at me, then turns her gaze on the detectives. I think she might be talking about a woman called Sheila Watts. I recently found out that she might have stolen the identity of Daphne Hartle. Both detectives lean towards Mum.
Go on, says D.S. Barnes.
As Sheila Watts drowned back in the late 1970s, my mother had an article about it in her things,
I did some digging and, to cut a long story short, it appears that Sheila Watts could have faked her death and stolen the real Daphne Hartle's identity. A flicker of irritation crosses D.S. Barnes's craggy face. Why didn't you mention this before? I'm sorry, a lot has happened over the last few days. I meant to. D.S. Barnes looks a little shamefaced.
Of course.
He addresses Gran again, his voice grave, like that of a newsreader about to impart doom.
Neil Lewisham was an investigative journalist. He often went on benders and, according to his son, had a turbulent relationship with his wife. Did he come all the way to Beggar's Nook that day to see Daphne because he found out she was really Sheila Watts, Rose?
There is urgency to his voice, as if he knows time is running out before Gran reverts back into herself. Gran doesn't say anything. Her mouth a stubborn line. Did Neil Lewisham find out about Daphne? Probes DC Webb to Gran, in her smooth, liquid voice. That she was really Sheila?
No,
says Gran, looking up at the detectives and fiddling with the necklace at her throat. He found out about Jean. Chapter 38, Rose. April, 1980. The day before Neil Lewisham turned up on our doorstep, everything had been perfect. Easter fell on the first weekend in April. We had a wonderful time celebrating it, just the three of us. Daphne boiled some eggs she'd been given at the farm, and we sat at the kitchen table, painting them. You giggling at the funny faces Daphne drew. She was surprisingly good. On Easter Sunday, we hid little hollow chocolate eggs in the garden, the colourful foil wrappers glinting beneath the plants and bushes. It was a sunny but crisp day. I'll never forget the delight in your eyes and your squeals of excitement as you hunted them out, Daphne and I standing by the back door of the cottage, proudly watching you. Later that night, while you slept, Daphne and I sat up talking and drinking wine by the fire. And then she turned to me, her eyes huge in the firelight. I want to say something to you, Rose, but I'm scared it will ruin our friendship. I moved closer to her, hoping she would say everything I felt. You can never tell me anything that would ruin our friendship, I said softly. She took my hand and moved towards me so that our faces were mere inches apart. She brushed her hair tenderly away from my face. I leant towards her, my heart fluttering as her lips brushed mine, and she pulled me close, kissing me deeply. She took my hand and led me upstairs to her bedroom, where I stayed until the early hours of the morning, creeping back into my own bed, so that you wouldn't be alarmed when you came looking for me when you woke up. I wish I'd drunk in every wonderful moment of that day, scrutinised each second under a magnifying glass. Daphne's throaty laugh, your squeals of delight, the way the sun bounced off the little foiled eggs, the smell of chocolate and pollen on the breeze. I'd give anything to relive that day on a loop. Over and over again. Because the next day, everything changed. He arrived on Monday evening, just as I was putting you to bed. I could hear voices in the hallway, but they were muffled, although I was sure one of the voices was male. My heart began to beat faster. We never had callers. I finished tucking you up and closed your bedroom door behind me, sweat pooling under my armpits at the thought of who could be at the front door. Was it the man Daphne was so afraid of? Had he found us? I rushed downstairs, different scenarios playing out in my head. But Daphne wasn't with anyone.
She was alone. Who is that? I asked quietly, not wanting to scare you. I heard you talking to someone. She shook her head and walked into the living room. I followed. She stood in the middle of the room, wrapping her arms around herself. Her face was so pale she looked as if she might faint. It's him, she whispered. Oh God, Rose, he's found me. He's found me. Coldness washed over me. Where is he now? He's gone round the side, to the garden. I said I'd talk to him there. I didn't know what to do. We need to call the police. I headed for the orange phone by the sofa, but she stopped me before I could reach it. We can't, don't you see? That will make no difference. It never has before. They didn't help me then. Why would they now? I hung my head. How I wished I had just called the police. Then maybe none of this would have happened. Fear. It makes you do strange things. It clouds the brain. And I had been so scared for so long. You have to believe me on that. Daphne put her hand on my shoulder. I need to talk to him. Try to convince him to leave me alone. I don't know if it'll work. She let out a small sob. I'm scared, Rose. He's not a nice man. Her words conjured up images of your father and the things he did to me. What would I do if he decided to turn up here, unannounced, like this Neil? I pulled Daphne into my arms, kissing the top of her head. It'll be okay. I won't let anything happen to you, I said fiercely. We'll sort this out together. Come on. I pulled away from her and took her hand, leading her into the kitchen. I could see a man standing in the garden, smoking. I didn't think about my safety, or even, I'm ashamed to admit, yours in that moment. I told myself Neil wasn't interested in us. It was Daphne he wanted. Daphne he had been looking for. I opened the back door, and Daphne stepped in front of me and out onto the patio. Hello, Jean, he said to her. Light spilled from the kitchen, illuminating his face. He was very fair with translucent eyelashes. He had on a black Harrington jacket with a white t-shirt underneath, and jeans. He smelled of stale alcohol. Jean.
Who's this?
He inclined his head towards me. My best friend, she replied, turning back to look at me. Her eyes locked with mine, and something unsaid passed between us. We were two 30-something women who had known each other for 4 months. I hadn't had a best friend since school. Yet it was still not enough to encapsulate the intensity of my feelings for her.
You better be careful, he said to me. His eyes narrowed, but a smug expression on his face. Don't you know what this woman is capable of?
Here we go, I thought, trying to make out that Daphne was the bad person, the one in the wrong. I'd seen a black and white film about it once. What do they call men like him? Gaslighters? I stood there, shivering in my cardigan and long skirt, not saying anything, just glaring at him in response. He took a puff of his cigarette and blew it out slowly and deliberately in my direction. I felt an intense hatred towards him in that moment. Daphne moved towards him, but I grabbed her hand and tried to pull her back. You don't have to, I said. She shook her head. I was surprised at her compliance. After all her talk of standing up to men. She shrugged me off.
walking towards him. She looked thin in a cotton jumper and flared jeans. She had on her trusty boots and they sank into the grass as she stood next to him, their backs to me. I could smell the hint of a bonfire from a neighbouring garden and, other than the light from the kitchen, it was pitch black outside, the kind of darkness you only get in the countryside, with no pollution, hardly any lights, and the thick, dense wood at the back. The hedges on either side were high, eclipsing any views from neighbours. Was I thinking of it then? Planning it? I think on some level, I must have been. I waited by the back door, watching, listening, like an animal ready to pounce. Their voices floated towards me. "After all these years," I heard him say. I could see the tip of his cigarette, a dot of amber against the darkness like a firefly. "I knew I'd find you, even with that fucking ugly hairstyle. You can't hide from me, Jean." "My name is Daphne," she said firmly. I noticed how her shoulders tensed. Her neck looked long and elegant with her hair so short. "I don't know why you keep referring to me as Jean. I'm not who you think I am." He lowered his voice, but I could still hear him. "We both know you are." His words sounded threatening, although I wasn't sure why. Not then, anyhow. "Exposing you is going to make my career." I wondered what he meant, and then it made sense. He was a policeman. No wonder Daphne didn't want me to ring them. He was one of them. Men who abused their power. Men others automatically believed. Like Victor Carmichael. Victor was a piece of scum, masquerading as an upstanding member of the community. A doctor, no less. Nobody would have believed me over him. He tried to ruin my life, and it looked like Neil had done the same to Daphne. "I'll just run away again," I heard her say, her voice sounding small in the darkness. "And I'll always find you." "Not this time." "Faking your death. That was clever, I'll give you that. But you're not clever enough, Jean." My blood pounded in my ears. I didn't want Daphne to leave. I loved her, I realised. She made me happy. I didn't want to live a life without her. I wanted it to stay the way it was, the three of us living in this cottage, safe. We were, until Neil had turned up, tainting our lovely world. Was it the idea of Victor and the way he had treated me that made me do it? Was it the thought of Daphne forever running away, never able to be with me, with us? I was so angry, so fed up with being powerless. For once, I wanted to be proactive, not passive. I wanted to be the one in charge. I just wanted to make it all go away, make him go away. I watched as he trailed a finger down her cheek and neck, his face too close to hers. Then he gripped Daphne's upper arms and pushed her back against the wall of the cottage. "You're a liar," he snarled. I saw the fear in her face, and it took me right back to the time Victor had first hit me. When I realised that not all men were kind-hearted like my father had been. A naive little fool. But I wasn't that person anymore. You had changed me. Daphne had changed me. I needed to protect her and the life the three of us had.
"Leave her alone,"
I called from the doorway. It was like snapshots flashing before my eyes. Daphne's fear, the sneer on Neil's face, as though he was enjoying the power. I don't remember snatching the bread knife from the block on the counter. I don't remember striding across the patio and plunging it just below his ribcage in one swift movement. It was all so quick. I let go of the knife in shock at what I'd done, stumbling backwards, catching sight of the horror on Daphne's face.
"You bitch,"
Neil rasped, dropping to his knees on the lawn.
"You fucking bitch!"
He clutched the handle of the knife where it protruded from his stomach. My hands flew to my mouth. Oh, God, oh, God, what had I done? Neil flopped backwards onto the grass, his hands still around the knife handle. Blood soaked the front of his t-shirt, a bloom of crimson against white. There was so much of it. I started to gag in horror. Daphne was by my side in an instant, her arm around my shoulders. "It's okay," she said gently. "It's okay. Oh, Rose, Rose. The police. I need to ring the police." I felt like I'd been winded. Neil was now lying prostrate on the ground, his pale eyelashes fluttering. Daphne bent down and pulled the knife out of his wound, but it seemed to make things worse, the blood pumping out faster than before, gushing over his fingers as he held onto his stomach, groaning. I took off my cardigan. "Quick, let's try to stem it with this," I said. She shook her head. "He's dying, Rose." Her voice was clipped, matter of fact, emotionless.
"I need to tell the police,"
I sobbed. "No. No, you don't."
"I do. We could save him."
"You want to save him? A man like him? A bully? A nasty fucking piece of shit?"
"I..."
We were interrupted by moaning coming from Neil. I knelt down and pressed my balled-up cardigan against his stomach. As I did so, he grasped my hand with such force that he unbalanced me and I toppled backwards.
"Now you're both murderers,"
he hissed, spittle flying out of his mouth and landing on his chin.
"You're both the same."
A jolt of shock. "What?"
"She's Jean Burden," he said,
his finger pointing towards Daphne, who was standing behind me.
"Jean Burden."
"Shut up," I hissed, my mouth dry. "Stop talking. I'm trying to help you." I got back on my knees and leant over him. He repulsed me, but I couldn't let him die. Panic engulfed me.
"Daphne!"
I shouted behind me.
"Call an ambulance!"
She knelt down beside me. "I'm not calling anyone, Rose," she said calmly. I felt her hand on my shoulder. "We need to let Neil die." His eyes were closed now, and his face had a sheen to it. Was he already dead? I was shaking uncontrollably. I couldn't take my eyes off him, this waxwork man lying on my lawn. Daphne grabbed my arm and pulled me up. "If we call the ambulance, the police will be notified, and you'll go to prison," she whispered. "Lolly will be taken away from you. You won't be able to see her ever again." "You don't want to go to prison, Rose. Believe me." What did she mean? Was she talking from experience? I closed my eyes. What would become of you if I went to prison? When I opened them, Daphne was staring at me, her beautiful face serious. She held my hand.
grounding me, calming me. She smoothed the hair from my forehead, kissed my face, my lips.
Please, listen to me, Rose.
Her voice was low, soft.
This is for the best.
We turned back to Neil, standing over him as the life seeped out of his body. He was somebody's son, somebody's brother, perhaps, maybe a husband, father. And I had killed him. I'd had the chance to try to save him, yet I did nothing. I stood with Daphne, our arms around each other, too shocked even to cry. And we waited until we were sure that he was dead.
What do we do now? I said. I think we need to bury him, she replied.
Bury him? I gasped. Bury him where? In the woods?
No, not the woods. That's too dangerous. Someone might see us. We need to do it here, in the garden.
I clamped my hand over my mouth. I can't, I said, through my fingers. Not here. Not where Lolly plays. Not where we hid Easter eggs. I started crying then, hot tears cascading down my cheeks.
Rose, she said gently, you're not a bad person. You were protecting me. She put her hand up to my face and gently wiped a tear away. And I'll owe you that for the rest of our lives. I'll never forget what you've done for me. But now, you need to be strong. For Lolly.
I nodded. She was right. What choice did I have?
That's what I told myself anyway. It was only later, much later, after we spent hours digging and burying a full-grown man along with my blood-stained cardigan, that I allowed myself to think about what Neil had said as he was dying. You're both murderers now.
Chapter 39. Safi. What do you mean, Gran? I ask.
Who is Jean? Jean Burden, says Gran, a tinge of impatience in her voice. Neil Lewisham thought Daphne was Jean Burden.
I notice the detectives exchanging shocked glances, and I hear a gasp from Mum.
Who is Jean Burden? I ask, confused. Why does that name ring a bell?
And then I remember that article in Sheila's file. It had been about a Burden. Was the first name Jean? I'd only scanned it. I hadn't recognised the name and assumed it had ended up in the wrong file. I could kick myself. I should have read it properly. If I'd seen it had said Jean, I would have remembered Gran's ramblings.
Jean hit her over the head.
Have you heard of Mary Bell? Asks D.S. Barnes.
I nod. She was a convicted child killer.
Yes. And Jean Burden's case was similar, but about 10 years before. When she left prison as a young woman, she was given a new identity and was never heard of again.
He addresses Gran.
Is that who you mean, Rose? Jean Burden, who killed her friend back in the early 1950s? In East London?
I feel shaken. I notice Mum is looking at Gran in horror. Gran nods, folding her hands in her lap.
And was she?
DC Webb asks, sitting forward in her seat.
Was Daphne really Jean Burden?
I... Gran wrings her hands.
Rose, says DC Webb,
resting her elbows on the table. Did Daphne kill Neil Lewisham? Gran purses her lips together. A shadow passes across her face, and I wonder what she's thinking.
Who is Neil Lewisham?
She turns to me.
Who are these people?
She waves her arm in the direction of the police, and Mum too. My heart sinks. I think Gran's had enough, I say, reaching for her hand.
Rose, can you remember if Daphne killed Neil Lewisham?
Persists D.S. Barnes. He sounds desperate to keep the interview going, but Gran is shaking her head, staring at him blankly, but refusing to say anything else. The detectives exchange resigned glances.
We'll have to pick this up another day, says D.S. Barnes to me and Mum.
It's not until we're leaving the room that I hear D.C. Webb mutter to her colleague. I think we need to look into the other body being that of Daphne Hartall. Have you heard of Jean Burden? I ask Mum on the drive home. The tension between us is still almost palpable after our earlier argument. Yes, of course, she says crisply. You'd be too young, perhaps. The Jean Burden case was overshadowed by Mary Bell. Who did Jean Burden kill? Another little girl. Jean was only 10 when it happened. And so was the girl she killed. Obviously, it was before my time. But I remember reading about it. I feel sick. God, that's awful. Imagine finding out that about your lodger. Mum nods grimly. Do you think Daphne killed Neil Lewisham because he found out she was Jean Burden? I ask. Mum looks pained. It's possible. Especially if he was a journalist. It makes sense. But then, I say, my mouth dry. If Daphne is the other body, who killed her? When I arrive back at the cottage, Tom is out with Snowy. I go straight to my study and look again at the article Dad sent me from Sheila's file. It's a short Vox Pop-style piece written by Neil, asking whatever became of Jean Burden and interviews with some of the public about possible sightings. Then I type Jean Burden's name into Google, and a number of entries pop up, mostly newspaper reports accompanied by a grainy black-and-white photo of a young, chubby-faced girl with a bob. I click on a link. 17th of February, 1951. The Daily Mail. Girl, 11. Convicted of murder. An 11-year-old girl has been sentenced to life after being found guilty of murder at the Old Bailey. Jean Burden remained composed and expressionless as the guilty verdict was read out after a 4-hour deliberation by the jury. Jean Burden is said to have struck the temple with a blunt object of 10-year-old Susan Wallace in an unprovoked attack on the 20th of June last year. Susan was found dead in a derelict bomb-shattered building by two passing boys. Mr. Justice Downing described her as a dangerous risk to other children and said she will be held in a secure unit for many years. Mum walks into the study, carrying a mug of tea. Here we are, Redbush, she says, placing it carefully on my desk. I don't know how you can drink that stuff. The smell turns my stomach. Look at this, I say. And Mum reads the article over my shoulder. Do you think Daphne Hartall could really have been this person? Well, it's possible that Sheila Watts was the new identity given to Jean Burden. And Gran found out. She must have done. She mentioned a Susan Wallace too, didn't she? Do you remember? When she was talking about Jean? You don't think she's just confused
because this was a high-profile case and she remembers it from childhood? I ask, hopefully. Mum glances at me with concern.
I don't think so, she says. I'm sorry.
I feel tears pressing. The police are going to think Daphne killed Neil Lewisham, aren't they? And that Gran found out and killed Daphne. They've got a motive now. Mum pats my shoulder.
They'll need more evidence before they can go down that route. Don't worry, she says.
But she doesn't sound convinced.
Do you think the private detective is working for Daphne, Sheila, Jean, whatever her name is?
That's if she isn't the other body, of course.
What makes you say that?
Well, Davies said his client is looking for some important paperwork, and you said he called it evidence. What else could he mean? He's obviously some kind of thug, and whoever he's working for sounds desperate.
I've told the police everything we know about Glenn Davies. Hopefully they'll talk to him and make him tell them who he's working for.
Daphne would be old now, though, I say doubtfully, rubbing my temple. I can feel a headache coming on. I think of Gran, not how she is now, but how she was when I was growing up. Strong, dependable, kind, but private. She obviously had more secrets than Mum and I ever realized. But she was so fiercely loyal, so protective, like a lioness. If Daphne is the other body and she was really Jean Burden, she could have been dangerous, unhinged. Could Gran have killed her to protect her daughter? I place my hand on my bump, remembering how protective I felt last night after coming back from the hospital. I can't believe Gran might be a killer, I say, thinking aloud. I turn to Mum, who has taken a seat on the little cocktail chair in the corner. She doesn't look as if she's listening. Mum?
We need to talk about what you said in the car.
I turn back to my computer. We have more pressing things to think about.
I don't want there to be any bad feeling between us. I love you so much.
And I love you too, I say. Please, can't we just forget it? It was a silly argument. Mum opens her mouth to say more, but we're interrupted by a knock at the door. We stare at each other. My first thought is that it's him. Davies.
Stay there,
Mum says, getting up and going to the front door. I lean back in my chair to see her peering through the glass.
It's a young couple, she says, sounding puzzled.
Not journalists. It's Saturday afternoon. Who else would be calling at this time?
They don't look like journalists.
She opens the door. I get up and stand beside her, wondering who it is. I'm surprised to see a couple in their late 20s or early 30s standing there. A small, pretty woman with a bang curled like a pineapple on her head, and a tall guy with a mass of dark floppy hair and warm brown eyes. He has a friendly, handsome face and a dimple when he smiles. He's almost as tall as Tom and looks relaxed in a t-shirt and jeans.
Hi,
he says, blushing slightly.
I'm Theo Carmichael, and this is my wife, Jen.
She smiles a hello.
I know this sounds crazy, and I hope you don't mind us showing up like this.
I stare at them, perplexed. Are they neighbours? Jehovah's Witnesses?
But I found this article on my dad's desk the other week.
He hands the article to me, and I scan it. It's about the bodies found in the garden, and someone has underlined my name and Gran's. And at the bottom, in sprawling writing, are the words, "Find her."
How weird, I say, handing the article to Mum. I'm Saffron Cutler, and my grandmother is Rose Gray. You said you found this on your father's desk. What's his name?
Victor Carmichael.
I think he must have known your gran.
He has a slight Yorkshire accent.
Victor. I'm too shocked to answer right away. My grandmother talked about a Victor. We didn't understand who she meant, as she couldn't remember his surname. She has dementia now, I add, when he looks at me with a bemused expression. I survey them both. Do you want to come in? I find myself asking. They nod gratefully and step into the hallway. I guide them to the living room.
What are you doing?
Mum mouths.
They seem fine, I whisper back. We need answers.
Theo and Jen take a seat on the sofa, and Theo drops his backpack to his feet. Can I get you a drink? Mum asks, as I sit in the armchair by the window.
We're okay, thanks, says Jen. We're staying at the pub down the road and had a late lunch.
We've come all the way from Yorkshire, says Theo, as Mum perches on a chair by the fireplace. Look, I'll cut to the chase, but I think my dad is hiding something. He's been acting really weird. Well, he gives a short laugh. Weirder than usual. He wouldn't tell me why he'd written "find her" on the article, or give me any information when I asked. He was very defensive and prickly. And then I found a folder hidden in this secret space of his in a cupboard. It was filled with photographs of women. I was wondering if one of these is your gran. He offers me the phone, and I get up to take it from him. Still standing up, I flick through them. They are all of pretty young women. One is heavily pregnant. By the fashions and haircuts, it looks as though they span a 20-year period. No, I say, handing him back the phone. None of these is gran. I sit back down. Oh. He looks disappointed. You said your gran mentioned a Victor. What did she say about him? I throw Mum an awkward look. I say, turning to Theo. She said something about how he wanted to hurt the baby. Theo looks shocked. Hurt the baby? My dad is a doctor. He might be many things. His expression darkens. But hurting babies? Jen reaches for his hand. We plunge into an uncomfortable silence until Mum pipes up. How old is your dad? My mother, Rose, is in her 70s. My dad was old when he had me. My mum was much younger. Dad is 76. So they're the same age. Could they have been together at some point? Theo shrugs. I really don't know. Did Rose say anything else about my dad? She gets really confused, I say, as explanation. She mentions lots of names. She mentioned Victor a few times, but when she did, she seemed, well, scared. Theo pales. Scared? Maybe scared is the wrong word, I frown, trying to remember. Agitated. She definitely said he wanted to hurt the baby. She made him sound, I'm sorry, this is a bit blunt, but she made him sound like he wasn't a good man. Theo and his wife exchange a glance. I don't think he is a good man, he mutters, suddenly looking vulnerable, and my heart goes out to him. It's all been so strange since the bodies were discovered, says Mum. Have you heard of a Daphne Hartle? Theo shakes his head. She was Mum's lodger and lived here in 1980 as well. We think she was also known as Sheila Watts. Not heard of her, says Theo. I notice his hand is still intertwined with Jen's. I can tell they're as desperate for answers as we are.
We're trying to find her. Well, the police are, says Mum. There's something else too. A man approached me and Safi over the last few days saying he's a private detective, although he grabbed me off the street when I was walking home one night.
Jen gasps.
That's awful.
It was horrible, Mum says.
But he did say that his client hired him to find some paperwork that my mother has. He called it evidence.
Evidence? Jen frowns.
Yes, he didn't elaborate and I was terrified.
What was this man's name? Asks Theo. Did he say who he was working for?
No, says Mum. He refused to say, but he did give his name. Glenn Davies.
Wait, what?
Theo sits up straighter.
Glenn Davies?
Yes, that's what he told me, says Mum. And we think he broke in here looking for this so-called evidence.
I know a Glenn Davies, says Theo, his face draining of colour. He works for my father.
Chapter 40, Theo. He works for your father, cries the younger woman, Saffron. She looks incredulous, her big brown eyes wide. Theo feels sick to his stomach that his father's henchman, as he's always thought of him, has been here and terrorised these women. Yeah, Theo says, crossing then uncrossing his legs. He wishes he'd now taken them up on the offer of a drink. His mouth is so dry. He's known my father for years. I don't even know how. Before him, there was another guy, a similar type, ex-military. But he retired. I do know this much, though. Glenn Davies is definitely not a private detective. Then what does he actually do for your dad? Says the older woman. Laura, or was it Lorna? He's hardly been able to take it all in since he got here. Theo shrugs. What does he actually do? He's never been sure. I've always assumed he's like my dad's security. He comes to the house now and again, assesses the burglar alarms, gives dad advice, that kind of thing. My dad's a wealthy man, successful in his field. Well, Glenn Davies is a fucking bully, that's what he is, says Laura. No, Lorna. He's sure her name is Lorna. He broke into the house when my daughter had to go to the hospital. It's like he was waiting outside, waiting for us to leave, all of this. She stands up and paces the room, throwing her arms wide. Theo watches her, mesmerised. There's something very familiar about her, like he's met her before but can't quite think where. It has to have something to do with your father and those photos. She stops and rounds on Theo, holding out her hand. Can I see them? He does as she asks. They all watch expectantly as she flips through them. Then she makes a growling sound of frustration and passes the phone back to him. I don't recognise anyone. I was hoping my mother would be there. I've already looked, says Saffron. I know, I just wanted to see. Lorna throws her daughter an apologetic smile, and Theo feels a pang of longing for his old mother. He takes back his phone. He feels Lorna's frustration. Can you remember anything else Glenn asked you that night when he grabbed you? Just about the evidence. That was it. Oh, and he threatened me and said he'd hurt me or Safi. She flinches. If I told the police. Theo swallows, trying to quell the panic growing inside him. Has his father got something to do with the murders that took place here? Maybe he's on the wrong track with the folder of women, unless they're victims of his. I think my mum was running away from someone. A woman who knew her back then remembers her as being jittery and secretive. And she was apparently pregnant when she first arrived here, says Lorna, sitting down again. She fizzes with nervous energy, like a firework that's about to go off. And you think she was running from my dad? Lana glances towards her daughter, then back to Theo. I'm beginning to think so now. My mum was always so cagey about my dad. She said his name was William, but never showed me photos, never talked about him. It was like she wanted to forget him. Theo thinks of Cynthia Parsons. Was Rose a victim of his too? An ex who was running away from him because she was scared. An ex who was pregnant. Babe, says Jen, gently placing her hand on his arm. He knows what she's going to say. He's been thinking it too. Lorna looks just like his dad. The same curly dark hair, the wide nose, the shape of the eyes and chin. The reason that Lorna had seemed so familiar when he first walked into the room was because looking at her is like facing himself in the mirror. I think Victor might be my father, says Lorna before he can voice his suspicions. Saffron's hands fly to her mouth. Oh my God, she exclaims, standing up. Of course. I think so too, says Theo slowly. You're so like him. There's an awkward pause before Lorna says, so the baby he wanted to hurt, that was me. And if he wanted to hurt me, did that mean he wanted to hurt my mother as well? Why did she run away from him? Theo feels shame rising in him, shame by association. He wants to tell him he is nothing like his shitty father. I think he was abusive to my mum. I saw bruises. He was controlling, manipulative. Is he still with you, mum? Asks Lorna. He clears his throat. She died. She fell down the stairs. I'm so sorry. Saffron is still standing up, staring at them with her mouth hanging open. My niece, he thinks. So your dad must be the client that Glenn Davis was talking about? Asks Lorna. She's still sitting forward in her seat, her shapely eyebrows furrowed, elbows resting on her knees. And if that's the case, does that mean he's involved in the murders? Theo shuffles his weight on the uncomfortable sofa. Fuck. The body's in the garden. The newspaper clipping, hiring Glenn Davies to put the frighteners on these women. His own family. It's just the kind of despicable thing his father would do if it meant protecting himself. But murder? In his wildest nightmares, he hadn't expected that. Theo is exhausted by the time they get back to their room at the Stag and Pheasant. He flops onto their four-poster bed. From the sash windows, they have views of the woods. His throat is sore from all the talking he's done this afternoon. Jen climbs up onto the bed next to him. I can't believe it, she says. You have a half-sister. And my dad is a potential murderer, he replies. He still feels sick at the thought. Why else has he hired Glenn Davies? What did he do? What does he so desperately want Glenn to find? Oh, babe, she says, leaning into the crook of his arm and resting her head on his chest. I'm so sorry. Do you think your dad knew he had a daughter? I'm not sure. I can't work out if he had that newspaper clipping because the bodies had been discovered and he was close to getting found out for something, or because it told him where Rose is now. Murder, though, groans Theo. It's another thing entirely. And it... He stops, unable to voice what he's really thinking. What? Jen says, sitting up. He takes a deep breath. If my dad is capable of murder, it puts a whole different spin on my mum's accident. He sits up too, facing his wife. Jen, what if my dad killed my mum?